Lincoln, Disc 16.
In the final days of the journey, an unexpected development threatened the image of dignified courage that he was building. Alan Pinkerton, the head of the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, informed Judd of a plot to assassinate Lincoln as he passed through Baltimore. This was not the first warning of danger to the president-elect, but it seemed entitled to more credence than earlier alarms. Working for S.M. Felton, the president of the Philadelphia, Wilmington, and Baltimore Railroad, who feared that secessionists might sabotage bridges along his route, Pinkerton found anti-Lincoln sentiment rampant in Baltimore, a strongly pro-Southern city with a long reputation for street violence, and his operatives reported details of a plot to kill the president-elect. When Lincoln's train from Philadelphia arrived at the Calvert Street station, the president-elect and his party would have to get out and go across town to the Camden Street station in order to board the Baltimore and Ohio train for Washington. Just as Lincoln emerged from the narrow vestibule of the Calvert Street station, Cipriano Ferrandini, a Baltimore barber, and a few associates planned to assassinate him. Pinkerton urged the president-elect to leave Philadelphia immediately, passing through Baltimore on a night train before the conspirators could learn of his change of plans. Lincoln refused to alter his schedule. "I can't go tonight," he insisted. He was committed to raising the flag at Independence Hall the next morning, and he'd promised to address the Pennsylvania legislature at Harrisburg later in the day. He vowed he'd fulfill those engagements, under any and all circumstances, even if he met with death in doing so. The threat was clearly on his mind as he spoke at Independence Hall on February 22nd. The country must be saved on the basis of the Declaration of Independence, which promised liberty for all and offered hope to the world for all future time. If it can't be saved upon that principle, it'll be truly awful, he warned. I was about to say I would rather be assassinated on this spot than to surrender it. As he was leaving for Harrisburg, young Frederick W. Seward brought confidential news from Washington that both his father, the senator, and General Winfield Scott believed the Baltimore conspiracy was genuine. After Lincoln made the promised address to the Pennsylvania legislature, he and his most trusted advisers met to discuss the danger. Pinkerton proposed that Lincoln, traveling alone so as to avoid suspicion, should take a special train from Harrisburg to Philadelphia. There, incognito, he would board the 11 p.m. train to Baltimore, passing unrecognized through that city at about 3:30 a.m., and arriving unannounced in Washington 2.5 hours later. Judd endorsed the plan. Colonel Sumner denounced it as a damned piece of cowardice, and said it would be better to get a squad of cavalry to cut away to Washington. But Captain Pope favored Pinkerton's recommendation. After considerable discussion, David Davis, who had expressed no opinion, asked the president-elect, "What's your judgment on the matter?" Lincoln said he wasn't entirely convinced that there was a conspiracy, and he recognized that he might appear ridiculous in fleeing from a non-existent danger. On the other hand, he respected Pinkerton's professional judgment and was impressed that Frederick Seward's warnings confirmed those of the detective. He concluded, "Unless there are some other reasons besides fear of ridicule, I'm disposed to carry out Judd's plan." That left only the details to be arranged. Pinkerton wanted no one else in the presidential party to be told of the change of plans, but Lincoln insisted that his wife must know, as otherwise she'd be very much excited at his absence. Against Colonel Sumner's protest, Lehman was chosen as his only companion and bodyguard during the trip. Lehman may indeed have been, as Pinkerton said, a brainless, egotistical fool, but he was big, brave, and most important of all, willing to lay down his life to save Lincoln's. That evening, the president-elect quietly slipped out of the hotel in Harrisburg. He was unrecognized because, instead of the usual stovepipe hat that had become his trademark, he wore for the first time in his life a soft felt Kossuth hat someone in New York had given him. To help conceal his tall figure, his long overcoat was thrown loosely over his shoulders without his arms being in the sleeves. He boarded a special train in Harrisburg, where all telegraphic communication had been interrupted to prevent possible leaks to the conspirators. At Philadelphia, accompanied only by Pinkerton and Lehman, he entered a sleeping car of the train to Baltimore and occupied a berth Pinkerton had reserved for an invalid passenger. He was so tall that he couldn't stretch out on the bed. The train proceeded undisturbed to Baltimore, and, without being observed, Lincoln transferred to the Camden station and went on to Washington. Emerging from the car, he attracted no attention until a loud voice hailed him. "Abe, you can't play that on me." Pinkerton and Lehman turned to attack the stranger when Lincoln interposed, recognizing his old friend, Congressman E.B. Washburn, who'd learned of the plan and come to meet him. He quickly drove with Lincoln to Willard's Hotel at 14th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Inevitably, Lincoln's secret night ride attracted unfavorable comment. It took on elements of farce after an enterprising newspaperman, Joseph Howard, needing to flesh out his story for the New York Times, wrote that Lincoln hadn't merely fled from Harrisburg, but had disguised himself by wearing a Scotch plaid cap and a long military coat. Cartoonists presently portrayed the disguise as a tam and kilts. Even serious observers were troubled by the episode. "We take it for granted that Mr. Lincoln isn't wanting in personal courage," the New York Tribune editorialized, "but it wanted some proof that imminent and great danger had required him to take such a remarkable course." Soberly, George Templeton Strong recorded his hope that Lincoln could prove beyond cavil the existence of a Baltimore plot. Otherwise, this surreptitious nocturnal dodging or sneaking of the president-elect into his capital city will be used to damage his moral position and throw ridicule on his administration. Eventually, the furor died down. But Lincoln came to regret that he'd allowed himself to be persuaded to undertake the night trip. As he told the Illinois Congressman Isaac N. Arnold, "I didn't then, nor do I now, believe I should have been assassinated had I gone through Baltimore as first contemplated. But I thought it wise to run no risk where no risk was necessary." That was a sound and reasonable decision. But it did nothing to sustain the reputation for firmness that he'd been so carefully building on his long journey from Springfield. The 10 days between Lincoln's arrival in Washington and his inauguration were among the busiest in his life. On the first day, after he reached Willard's Hotel, he telegraphed Mary in Harrisburg of his safe arrival. He and Seward had breakfast together and then went to the White House, where he met President Buchanan and was introduced to the members of the cabinet. After calling on General Scott, who was not at home, he rode about Washington for an hour with Seward, who found him very cordial and kind, simple, natural, and agreeable. In the afternoon, he received visitors, including Montgomery Blair, soon to be his postmaster general, and his father, Francis P. Blair, Sr. In mid-afternoon, Mary Lincoln and the boys arrived after an uneventful trip through Baltimore, and the family was reunited in the best suite at the hotel. Senator Douglas and other members of the Illinois delegation called later in the day, and the encounter between the two old rivals, both ardent supporters of the Union, was reported to be peculiarly pleasant. At 7 p.m., he took a carriage to Seward's residence and dined privately with his Secretary of State designate and Vice President-elect Hamlin. Returning to Willard's, he found the long hall lined with people and became so absorbed in greeting them that he forgot to remove his hat. Delegates from the peace conference, which was just ending its unprofitable deliberations, called at 9 p.m. and found the president-elect standing unattended in the public drawing room of the hotel. Senator Chase and Lucius E. Chittenden, who represented Vermont at the conference, took it upon themselves to introduce the delegates. Afterward, Lincoln held an informal reception for members of Congress and other guests who'd crowded into the hotel. Among them was the wealthy New York merchant William E. Dodge, who warned the president-elect that only concessions to the South could prevent national bankruptcy. "It was up to Lincoln to say whether the grass shall grow in the streets of our commercial cities." Looking quizzical, Lincoln responded that he preferred to see the grass grow in fields and in meadows, but that he'd defend the Constitution, let the grass grow where it may. At 10 p.m., the members of Buchanan's cabinet called to pay their respects. Not until they left could the weary president-elect go to bed. The days that followed were similarly filled with endless calls and receptions. Both Vice President John C. Breckinridge and John Bell, like Douglas, defeated candidates in the 1860 election, paid their respects. Lincoln welcomed a call from the aged and infirm General Scott, dressed in his full military regalia and wearing all his medals. The president-elect visited the Capitol and held an informal reception for members of Congress. He greeted the justices of the Supreme Court. Mayor James G. Barrett and the Common Council of Washington tendered an official welcome to the city and, understanding that they had opposed his election, Lincoln expressed hope that when we shall become better acquainted, and I say it with great confidence, we shall like each other the more. On most evenings, he and Mary received visitors in the hotel parlors. Some came out of a sense of duty, some in hope of securing public office, and some out of idle curiosity. One Virginian described the president-elect as a cross between a sandhill crane and an Andalusian jackass, vain, weak, puerile, hypocritical, without manners, without moral grace. But most visitors thought him awkwardly charming. At parties, he was relaxed and sociable. When he attended the dinner that Rudolf Schleiden, the minister from Bremen and the dean of the diplomatic corps in Washington, gave in his honor, he favorably impressed Lord Lyons, the British minister, and most of the other diplomats, though the ambassador from Holland complained, "His conversation consists of vulgar anecdotes at which he himself laughs uproariously." All this socializing allowed the president-elect to sound Washington's sentiment about the crisis. No words were more welcome than those of Douglas, who strongly favored conciliating the South and urged Lincoln to persuade Republicans to compromise. At the same time, he pledged that he and his Democratic followers wouldn't try to gain political advantage from the crisis. "Our Union must be preserved," he told Lincoln solemnly. "Partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you." Touched and greatly cheered, Lincoln responded, "With all my heart, I thank you. The people with us, and God helping us, all will yet be well." When the senator left, Lincoln exclaimed to another visitor, "What a noble man Douglas is." Lincoln's numerous conferences in the week before his inauguration also helped him make a final selection of his cabinet members. Until he arrived in Washington, only Seward and Bates had been formally offered posts. After the McClure-Curtin faction withdrew their objection, Cameron was assured of a place, and Pennsylvanians insisted that he must head the Treasury Department. But there was a mounting cry for Chase to have that appointment. To settle the controversy, Lincoln sought the advice of the Republican senators. Sending for them in alphabetical order, he asked their preferences for Secretary of the Treasury. Of the 19 who responded, 5 wasted their votes on Dayton and James F. Simmons, a justly forgotten senator from Rhode Island. 3 cast votes for Cameron, and 11 favored Chase. With that, Lincoln had a mandate, and he offered the Treasury Department to Chase. Cameron was given a choice of the War Department or the Interior Department, and rather grumpily chose the former. The appointment suggested how far Lincoln was from thinking about a war. The selection of Chase was a bitter dose for Seward, who'd increasingly come to think of himself as the premier of the incoming Lincoln administration. In his mind, the brilliant policy he'd pursued in the Senate had saved the country during the months since the election. By conciliating the South, he believed that he'd stopped the hemorrhage of secession after the withdrawal of the 7 states of the lower South. Though the legislatures of Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas authorized conventions to consider secession, Unionists were in control in all these states. He was convinced that they'd remain loyal so long as peace was preserved. Seward didn't take seriously Lincoln's remarks made on the way to Washington, and was confident he could persuade the president-elect to agree that the fever of secession should be allowed to run its course in the Deep South, while Unionism should be fostered in the Upper South by avoiding all provocations. He didn't count on impressing Lincoln by his appearance. Slight in build, stooped and thin, with sallow complexion, a beak-like nose, and shaggy eyebrows, he was, unlike Chase, not an imposing figure. But he counted on his enormous intelligence and undeniable charm to win over the president-elect, and was constantly with him at breakfasts, meetings, receptions, and dinners. Delighted with Seward's ebullience and lack of pomposity, and sharing his fondness for jokes, Lincoln appeared docilely to follow the lead of his premier. "Old Abe is honest as the sun and means to be true and faithful," growled Greeley, who distrusted Seward. "But he's in the web of very cunning spiders and can't work out if he would." In naming Chase, Lincoln broke out of the web. Seward was furious, but he couldn't have been surprised. He already knew from reading the draft of the inaugural address at the request of the president-elect that his policies were not Lincoln's. Selecting Chase, who bluntly denounced secession and made his motto, "Inauguration first, adjustment afterwards," was a further signal that Lincoln wasn't going to follow Seward's cautious and conciliatory approach toward the South. Frustrated and despondent, Seward remonstrated with Lincoln. He told the president-elect that he and Chase had irreconcilable differences. Out of his conviction of duty and what was due to himself, he must insist on excluding Mr. Chase if he, Seward, remained. Failing to convince Lincoln, Seward on March 2nd dashed off a curt note. "Circumstances which have occurred since I expressed my willingness to accept the office of Secretary of State seem to me to render it my duty to ask leave to withdraw that consent." Lincoln faced a dilemma. He needed the New Yorker in his cabinet. But as he told Nicolay, "I can't afford to let Seward take the first trick." He signaled that Seward was not irreplaceable. When a deputation of New York merchants friendly to Seward descended on the president-elect to protest the appointment of Chase, he listened to their argument that Chase's commitment to free trade and his hostility toward compromise with the South would further injure business prospects. Beyond that, they insisted, Seward could never work with Chase. Agreeing that he needed a harmonious administration, Lincoln brought out two lists. One, his preferred choice of cabinet members, which included both Seward and Chase, and the other, he said, a poorer one, naming Dayton as Secretary of State, with Seward as Minister to England. With that, the stunned delegation shuffled out. He gave the same message to Judd, who was vastly excited about possible last-minute changes in the cabinet list. Knowing that Judd was an intimate of Weed and that anything said to him would be immediately reported to Seward, the president-elect vowed, "When that slate breaks again, it'll break at the top." But Lincoln said nothing directly to Seward, and he didn't even acknowledge Seward's letter of withdrawal. On Sunday, the day before the inauguration, just as though nothing had happened, the president-elect gave a dinner party for all the prospective members of his cabinet, including both Seward and Chase. The next morning, while the inauguration procession was forming, he sent Seward a brief note, asking him to reconsider his decision. Lincoln's tactful handling of a difficult situation gave Seward time to reflect. Genuinely worried about the fate of the nation, the New Yorker felt that he did not dare to go home or to England and leave the country to chance, that is, to Abraham Lincoln. He continued to doubt Lincoln's plan for what he termed a compound cabinet, but he told his wife, "I believe I can endure as much as anyone, and may be that I can endure enough to make the experiment successful." He agreed to serve. At noon on March 4th, James Buchanan and Abraham Lincoln entered an open barouche at Willard's Hotel and began the drive down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. Determined to prevent any attempt on Lincoln's life, General Scott had stationed sharpshooters on the roofs of buildings along the avenue, and companies of soldiers blocked off the cross streets. He stationed himself with one battery of light artillery on Capitol Hill. General John E. Wool, commander of the Army's Department of the East, was with another. The presidential procession was short and businesslike. more like a military operation than a political parade. Entering the capital from the north through a passageway boarded so as to prevent any possible assassination attempt, Buchanan and Lincoln attended the swearing-in of Vice President Hannibal Hamlin, and then emerged, to a smattering of applause, on the platform erected at the East Portico. Introduced by his old friend, the silver-tongued E.D. Baker, Lincoln rose but was obviously troubled by what to do with his tall stovepipe hat. Noting his perplexity, Douglas said, "Permit me, sir," took the hat and held it during the ceremony. Lincoln read his inaugural, an eyewitness recalled, in a voice, though not very strong or full-toned, that rang out over the acres of people before him with surprising distinctness and was heard in the remotest parts of his audience. When he finished, the cadaverous Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, now nearly 84 years old, tottered forth to administer the oath of office to the 16th President of the United States. The audience couldn't be quite sure what the new president's policy toward secession would be, because his inaugural address, like his cabinet, was an imperfectly blended mixture of opposites. The draft that he completed before leaving Springfield was a no-nonsense document. It declared that the Union was indestructible, that secession was illegal, and that he intended to enforce the laws. "All the power at my disposal will be used to reclaim the public property and places which have fallen," he pledged, "to hold, occupy, and possess these and all other property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties on imports." Promising that there needs to be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none unless forced upon the national authority, Lincoln urged secessionists to pause for reflection. "In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. With you, and not with me, is the solemn question of shall it be peace or a sword?" Lincoln showed this warlike draft to several of his associates. David Davis's comments were not recorded. Francis P. Blair, Sr., remembering his glory days when Andrew Jackson stared down the South Carolina nullifiers, approved it and urged that no change be made. Browning found it able, well considered, and appropriate, but strongly advised Lincoln to delete the pledge to reclaim federal forts that had fallen into Confederate hands, because this would be construed into a threat or menace in the Deep South, and would be irritating in the border states. Lincoln accepted the suggestion. More significant were the changes that Seward advised. Granting that Lincoln's basic argument was strong and conclusive and ought not to be in any way abridged or modified, Seward thought the speech much too provocative. If Lincoln delivered it without alterations, he warned, Virginia and Maryland would secede, and within 60 days the Union would be obliged to fight the Confederacy for possession of the capital at Washington. Dozens of verbal changes should be made, deleting words and phrases that could appear to threaten the defeated, irritated, angered, frenzied people of the South. Something more than argument was needed to meet and remove prejudice and passion in the South, and despondency and fear in the East. Entreating Lincoln to include some words of affection, some of calm and cheerful confidence, he proposed a less martial concluding paragraph. "I close. We are not, we must not be aliens or enemies, but fellow countrymen and brethren. The mystic chords which, proceeding from so many battlefields and so many patriot graves, pass through all the hearts and all the hearths in this broad continent of ours, will yet again harmonize in their ancient music when breathed upon by the guardian angel of the nation. Lincoln made many of the changes Seward proposed. Seward's suggested final paragraph was too ornate for his taste, but he incorporated its ideas in language distinctively his own. "I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. The mystic chords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union, when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Reaction to the address was largely predictable. In the Confederacy, it was generally taken to mean that war was inevitable. A correspondent of the Charleston Mercury viewed this pronouncement from the orangutan at the White House as the tocsin of battle that was also the signal of our freedom. In the Upper South, the Richmond Dispatch said the message inaugurates civil war, and the Richmond Enquirer said it meant that Virginia must choose between invasion by Lincoln's army or Jefferson Davis's. In the North, Republican papers generally praised the address. The Indianapolis Daily Journal called it strong, straightforward, and manly, and the Detroit Daily Tribune found it able, firm, conciliatory, true to principle, and of transparent honesty. But the Albany Atlas and Argus, a Douglas paper, dismissed this rambling, discursive, questioning, loose-jointed stump speech. And the pro-Breckinridge Columbus Daily Capital City Fact predicted that Lincoln's policy meant that blood will stain the soil and color the waters of the entire continent. Brother will be arrayed in hostile front against brother. The most thoughtful verdict was offered by the Providence Daily Post, a Democratic paper, which seemed to sense the differences between Lincoln's original draft and the address that he actually delivered. If the president selected his words with the view of making clear his views, he was, partially at least, unsuccessful. There's some plain talk in the address, but it's immediately followed by obscurely stated qualifications. On the morning after the inauguration, Lincoln found on his desk a report from Major Robert Anderson that the provisions for his garrison at Fort Sumter would be exhausted in about 6 weeks. Unless he was resupplied within that time, he'd have to surrender. He warned that it would take a force of 20,000 well-disciplined men to make the fort secure. Lincoln was not prepared for this emergency. As yet, there was no executive branch of the government. The Senate had yet to confirm even his private secretary, John G. Nicolay. None of his cabinet officers had been approved. His secretary of state designate hadn't yet agreed to serve, and Salmon P. Chase hadn't even been informed of his nomination. Lincoln needed all the help he could get, because, as he freely admitted later, when he became president, he was entirely ignorant not only of the duties, but of the manner of doing the business in the executive office. He tried to do everything himself. There was no one to teach him rules and procedures, and he made egregious mistakes. For example, he thought he could issue orders directly to officers in the Navy without even informing Secretary Welles, and he attempted, without congressional authorization to create a new Bureau of Militia in the War Department, headed by his young friend Elmer Ellsworth. The difficulty with Mr. Lincoln is that he has no conception of his situation, Senator Charles Sumner concluded, and having no system in his composition, he has undertaken to manage the whole thing as if he knew all about it. The new president allowed office seekers to take up most of his time. From 9 o'clock in the morning until late at night, his White House office was open to all comers, and sometimes the petitioners were so numerous that it was impossible to climb the stairs. As Maine Senator William Pitt Fessenden said, they made up an ill-bred, ravenous crowd, and Lincoln lamented that he was considered fair game for everybody of that hungry lot. The pressure was so great, Nicolay wrote, that we have scarcely had time to eat, sleep, or even breathe. Browning scolded the president. You shouldn't permit your time to be consumed and your energies exhausted by personal applications for office. But Lincoln was incorrigible. With a sad smile, he explained to Henry Wilson, the Massachusetts senator, that these people don't want much and don't get but little, and I must see them. The news from Fort Sumter forced this inexperienced and overworked administrator to make a hard choice. He must either reinforce Anderson's garrison or evacuate it. Lincoln's options were sharply limited by two principles firmly enunciated in his inaugural address. One promised to avoid bloodshed or violence unless it be forced upon the national authority. The other pledged to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government. That included Fort Sumter. In the days after receiving the news from Anderson, Lincoln wrestled with his problem. He didn't come to conclusions quickly, and he was temperamentally averse to making bold moves. It was his style to react to decisions made by others, rather than to take the initiative himself. In these troubled hours, he made no public pronouncements and didn't even discuss the Sumter crisis at the first formal meeting of the cabinet on March 6th, which Attorney General Bates characterized as introductory and uninteresting. In subsequent informal conversations, the president told Gideon Welles that he wanted to avoid hasty action so as to gain time for the administration to get in working order and its policy to be understood. Before taking any action, Lincoln, with his usual caution, tried to verify the facts. He asked General Scott to answer a set of interrogatories similar to ones that he used in the courtroom. How long could Anderson maintain his position? Was Scott now able to reinforce Fort Sumter? If not, what additional resources did he need? He received the disheartening response that it would require a naval expedition, 5,000 regular army troops, and 20,000 volunteer soldiers to reinforce the fort. Since these couldn't be produced, surrender was merely a question of time. The Sumter crisis was the principal topic of discussion at a cabinet meeting on March 9th, when the secretaries learned for the first time how grave the situation was. If relieving Anderson required an expeditionary force of at least 25,000 men, at a time when the entire United States Army numbered only 16,000, mostly scattered in outposts along the Indian frontier, the inescapable conclusion was that the fort must be surrendered. Lincoln wasn't yet willing to accept that conclusion. Perhaps his reluctance was increased when Francis P. Blair, Sr. forced his way into the president's office and warned that evacuation of the fort was virtually a surrender of the Union, amounting to treason. The next day, the old gentleman apologized for having said things that were impertinent, but Lincoln got the message. He also learned that all military experts were not as pessimistic as General Scott. Former Navy Lieutenant Gustavus Vassa Fox, Mrs. Montgomery Blair's brother-in-law, who was knowledgeable about coastal defenses, had for some time been advocating a plan to reinforce or resupply Sumter from the sea. He would use powerful light-draft New York tugboats under the cover of night to run men and supplies from an offshore naval expedition to the fort. His plan got nowhere under the Buchanan administration, and Scott, with the traditional scorn that Army men showed for Navy planners, thought it was impracticable. Now Montgomery Blair, who was a West Point graduate, endorsed it, and Lincoln began to give it serious consideration. On March 15th, he asked each member of his cabinet to respond in writing to the question, "Assuming it to be possible to now provision Fort Sumter, under all the circumstances, is it wise to attempt it?" Seward took the lead in opposing any such attempt. An expedition to relieve Sumter would provoke combat and probably initiate a civil war. Cameron, Wells, and Smith echoed Seward's views. Chase took the opposite side of the question. He admitted having some doubts, and he didn't advise reinforcing Sumter if it would precipitate a war, with the necessity of enlisting large armies and spending millions of dollars that the Treasury didn't have. But on the whole, he thought this unlikely, and therefore voted in favor of resupplying Major Anderson. Montgomery Blair strongly urged an expedition. Southerners had been led to believe that the northern men are deficient in the courage necessary to maintain the government. Only prompt reinforcement of Anderson and his garrison could vindicate the hardy courage of the North and the determination of the people and their president to maintain the authority of the government. With his advisers divided, Lincoln was unable to reach a decision. As he saw it, his duty, from a purely military point of view, was clear. It was the mere matter of getting the garrison safely out of the fort. But evacuation would be utterly ruinous politically. By many, he explained to Congress a few months later, it'd be construed as part of a voluntary policy that at home would discourage the friends of the Union, embolden its adversaries, and go far to ensure to the latter a recognition abroad. In fact, it'd be our national destruction consummated. This could not be allowed, he concluded. But he didn't know how to avoid it. Like any other administrator facing impossible choices, he postponed action by calling for more information. After several conversations with Fox, to whom he took a great liking, he sent the lieutenant to Charleston, ostensibly to bring Anderson messages about possible evacuation, but in reality to get a first-hand look at the fort and the Confederate fortifications that threatened it. In an entirely separate move, the president put Seward's views about Southern Unionism to the test by asking Stephen A. Hurlbut, an old friend from Illinois who'd been born in Charleston, to go to South Carolina and ascertain the state of public opinion. Along with Hurlbut went Ward Hill Lehman, whose bibulous habits and open hostility to abolitionism might gain him access to a different class of South Carolinians. By this time, knowledge of the Sumter crisis had become general. From all sides, the president heard imperative voices. Neil Dow, the Republican leader from Maine, wrote that evacuation of the fort would be approved by the entire body of Republicans in this state, because it was undoubtedly a military necessity. Greeley's powerful New York Tribune spoke of allowing the southern states to go in peace and opposed the use of any force. In the Senate, which was still in session to confirm presidential appointments, Douglas said that South Carolina was entitled to Fort Sumter, and that Anderson and his gallant band should be instantly withdrawn. From faraway San Francisco, the Daily Alta California predicted that if Mr. Lincoln does withdraw the troops from Fort Sumter, secession is dead and every leader in the movement ruined. On the other extreme, some Republicans had long felt that the time had come for a test of strength with the South. Senator Zachariah Chandler, a blunt, hard-drinking Michigan businessman, held that without a little bloodletting, this union will not, in my estimation, be worth a rush. William Butler, Lincoln's old Springfield friend, grew so angry at the prospect of giving up Fort Sumter without a fight that he lost control of grammar and orthography in a letter to Trumbull. "Is it passable that Mr. Lincoln is getting scared? I know the responsibility is great, but for God's sake, tell Mr. L. to live by it, or have the credit, if credit it may be termed, of sinking in a righteous cause." A caucus of Republican congressmen warned the president that failure to reinforce Sumter would bring disaster to the party. Trumbull introduced a resolution in the Senate that "it's the duty of the president to use all the means in his power to hold and protect the public property of the United States." Amid these dissonant voices, Lincoln heard from his emissaries to South Carolina. Fox returned to Washington more confident than ever that it was possible to resupply Fort Sumter by sea at night. On March 27th, Hurlbut offered a bleak picture of public opinion in South Carolina. "Separate nationality is a fixed fact," he reported. "There's no attachment to the Union, positively nothing to appeal to." He judged that any attempt to reinforce Sumter would be received as an act of war. Even a ship known to contain only provisions for Sumter would be stopped and refused admittance. The next day, Lincoln received shocking advice from Scott. The general asserted that evacuation of Fort Sumter would not be enough to retain the loyalty of the Upper South, including Virginia, Scott's native state. It was necessary also to surrender Fort Pickens on the Florida coast, even though that fort was securely in Union hands and could be reinforced at will. Only such liberality would soothe and give confidence to the 8 remaining slaveholding states and render their cordial adherence to this union perpetual. Appalled, Lincoln managed to get through the first state dinner that he and Mary gave for members of his official family and distinguished guests that evening. But he asked the cabinet to remain after the others took their leave. Then, in a voice choked with emotion, he told them of Scott's recommendations. Blair erupted that the general wasn't offering military advice but playing politician. Except for Seward, whose views Scott was echoing, the others agreed. Lincoln gave notice that he would hold a formal council the next day. That night, he slept not at all, aware that the time had come for decision. The next morning, he was, he said, in the dumps. He got up deeply depressed, conscious that he would have to ask the cabinet, which met at noon, for a final judgment on whether attempts should be made to relieve Fort Sumter and Fort Pickens. Each member, except Cameron, who was absent, gave a written opinion. Seward remained obdurately opposed to sending an expedition to provision or reinforce Sumter, because it would precipitate a civil war. But sensing that the president was determined to take some action, he favored holding Fort Pickens at every cost. Caleb Smith agreed. Bates also thought Fort Pickens must be held at all hazards, and on Fort Sumter offered the unhelpful opinion that the time is come either to evacuate or relieve it. But now Chase and Wells came out unequivocally for reinforcing Sumter, and Blair threatened to resign if the president followed the advice of General Scott. The advice of the majority of the cabinet reinforced Lincoln's own view. He'd already asked Fox for a memorandum of the ships, men, and supplies he'd need to relieve Sumter. And now he directed Wells and Cameron to have an expedition ready to sail from New York by April 6th. To organize the fleet, Fox was sent to New York with verbal instructions to prepare for the voyage, but to make no binding engagements. The strain under which Lincoln labored in arriving at this decision was immense. All the troubles and anxieties of his life, he told Browning, didn't equal those he felt in these tense days. The pressure was so great that Mary Lincoln reported that he keeled over and had to be put to bed with one of his rare migraine headaches. A decision had been reached, but Seward wasn't willing to concede defeat. In the week between the crucial cabinet meeting and the date for the sailing of the fleet, he tried, with a growing sense of desperation, to reverse Lincoln's course, in the hope of avoiding hostilities he had, through intermediaries, been in touch with the official commissioners the Confederate government sent to Washington in order to negotiate terms of separation, and he'd given his word that the troops would be withdrawn from Fort Sumter. He was still confident he could negotiate a settlement of the crisis if Anderson's garrison was evacuated. Now he was trapped between his pledge and Lincoln's determination to proceed with a relief expedition. Seward first sought to escape his dilemma by bluster. On April 1st, he handed Lincoln a memorandum headed, "Some Thoughts for the President's Consideration." It began with the pronouncement, "We are at the end of a month's administration, and yet without a policy, either domestic or foreign." From there, the secretary went on to urge that the question before the public be changed from slavery, which was a party issue, to union or disunion. In order to bring about this shift, Fort Sumter should be evacuated, but Fort Pickens and the other minor forts in the Gulf of Mexico should be reinforced. Public interest should be diverted from domestic quarrels to foreign policy. In order to rouse a vigorous continental spirit of independence, he would demand explanations from Spain, which had sent troops to assist rebels in Santo Domingo, and France, which was showing too great an interest in Mexican affairs. He even added Great Britain and Russia to his list. If the French and Spanish governments didn't give satisfactory answers, he would convene Congress and declare war against them. Whatever policy we adopt, the memorandum concluded, there must be an energetic prosecution of it. Either the president must do it himself or devolve it on some member of his cabinet. It is not in my especial province, but I neither seek to evade nor assume responsibility. Lincoln left no record of how he felt about this extraordinary document, which he must have been tempted to dismiss as an April Fool's Day joke. Certainly he recognized it as another of Seward's attempts to play the role of premier in the administration. What hit a nerve was the secretary's assertion that the administration had no policy. Others shared this opinion. Senators Sumner and Fessenden were convinced that Lincoln had no fixed policy except to keep mum and see what end those seceding states will come to. Carl Schurz warned of general discontent throughout the North because Lincoln lacked leadership. Everybody, Schurz told the president, felt that any distinct line of policy, be it war or a recognition of the Southern Confederacy, would be better than this uncertain state of things. Touchy on this subject, Lincoln stiffly pointed out to Seward that he did have a policy, announced in his inaugural address, of holding, occupying, and possessing the forts and other property belonging to the government. Rightly interpreted, that meant a policy of not evacuating Fort Sumter. This policy, he reminded the secretary, had Seward's distinct approval at the time. Ignoring Seward's warlike threats against European powers, Lincoln turned to his concluding observation, that either the president must energetically prosecute whatever policy he adopted or delegate it to some member of the cabinet. Lincoln's answer was unequivocal. I remark that if this must be done, I must do it. Then, recognizing how sharp his reply was, he probably didn't send it. He kept the only known copy in his files and most likely discussed the memorandum with Seward, managing to combat its arguments without hurting the secretary's feelings. Certainly, Seward wasn't at all disheartened by the rejection of his memorandum, and he continued to urge the president to explore face-saving solutions to the Sumter crisis. Anxious to avoid war, Lincoln willingly joined in these efforts. One possibility was an agreement to surrender Fort Sumter in return for a pledge of unconditional loyalty on the part of Virginia. There was nothing inherently implausible about such a deal. Though many Virginians sympathized with the states of the Lower South, most were loyal to the Union, and Unionists had a clear majority in the state convention, which was still in session. The president hoped to confer with George W. Summers, the leading Unionist in that convention. But Summers declined to come to Washington. Instead, he sent John B. Baldwin, another Unionist, who had a long secret conference with Lincoln on April 4th. What the two men said became a matter of dispute. But according to the most reliable account, the president promised, "If you'll guarantee to me the state of Virginia, I shall remove the troops. A state for a fort is no bad business." Whether intentionally or inadvertently, Baldwin misunderstood the president, and nothing came of this offer. Another of Seward's schemes was to deflect the Sumter expedition by the successful reinforcement of Fort Pickens. That, it appeared, could be done without provoking hostilities with the Confederates. In his March 29th cabinet memorandum, Seward proposed, in lieu of reinforcing Sumter, to call on Captain Montgomery C. Meigs, the Army engineer in charge of construction at the Capitol, to organize an expedition to relieve Pickens. That same day, he brought Meigs to the White House. Fort Pickens, the president reminded the captain, had been virtually under siege since the secession of Florida. President Buchanan had sent 200 additional soldiers to the fort on the warship Brooklyn, but they hadn't been permitted to land. Under an informal truce, the Confederates promised not to attack the fort if it wasn't reinforced. On the day after his inauguration, Lincoln gave a verbal order to land the troops aboard the Brooklyn, only to discover, like many another president, that it was one thing to give an order and quite another to have it obeyed. On March 11th, he renewed the order in writing, and Scott dispatched a vessel to direct that the troops be landed. Lincoln still didn't know what had happened, but he told Meigs he guessed his order had fizzled out. Now he asked Meigs, who was already familiar with the Florida forts, to organize a relief expedition. Thus, two projects got underway at the same time. The Sumter mission, pressed chiefly by Wells and Blair, was largely a naval expedition commanded by Fox. The Pickens expedition, sponsored by Seward, was an army affair led by Meigs. The task forces preparing these fleets worked in secrecy, and partly because of inter-service rivalries, partly because of antagonisms among cabinet members, each was kept largely in the dark about what its rival was doing. Inevitably, there were contests for the limited resources available for these projects. Wells intended the Navy's most powerful steamer, the Powhatan, to be part of Fox's fleet, but Seward wanted it for Meigs's expedition. Placing an order assigning the ship to the Pickens fleet before the president in a pile of other documents, he got Lincoln's signature. On learning what had happened, Wells dragged Seward to the White House, where, though it was nearly midnight, Lincoln hadn't yet gone to bed. Confronted with the problem, he looked first at one and then the other and declared there was some mistake. Assured that there was no error, the president, as Wells remembered, took upon himself the whole blame, said it was carelessness, heedlessness on his part, and that he ought to have been more careful and attentive. He directed that the Powhatan be restored to Fox's expedition. Even then, there was further evidence of the total confusion that characterized the administration. Seward reluctantly telegraphed the president's message to New York, but the directive reassigning the ship was signed Seward. Lieutenant David D. Porter, in command of the Powhatan, received the new order just as he was leaving the New York harbor, but declined to follow it, as a directive from the Secretary of State could not supersede his original orders signed by the President of the United States. Consequently, the Powhatan sailed off to assist in the Pickens expedition, where it wasn't needed, and Fox's Sumter fleet was weakened through what Fox's wife called this cruel treachery. On April 4th, Lincoln decided to send Fox's expedition to Fort Sumter, and he notified Anderson that the fleet would attempt to provision the garrison and, in case it met resistance, to reinforce it. He'd taken a decisive step, but not yet an irrevocable one. Since the fleet didn't actually leave New York until 4 or 5 days later, he had a little more time for maneuver. That was cut drastically short on April 6th, when he learned, as he feared, that his order to reinforce Fort Pickens hadn't been carried out. Meigs's expedition couldn't possibly reach Fort Pickens before Fort Sumter must be reinforced or surrendered. By this time, Seward was almost reconciled to the inevitable, but he made one more attempt to avert hostilities. Because he'd given his word to the Confederate commissioners that Sumter would not be reinforced without notice, he wrung from the president a promise to warn South Carolina officials before sending a relief expedition. On April 6th, Lincoln sent Robert S. Chew, a clerk in the State Department, to Charleston, with orders to inform Governor Francis Pickens that an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with provisions only, and that if such attempt be not resisted, no effort to throw in men, arms, or ammunition will be made, without further notice. Intended to avoid provoking South Carolina authorities, this message destroyed the slight possibility that Anderson could be secretly reinforced. The president had little hope of results from Chew's mission. He knew from Hurlbut's report that the South Carolinians would attack any Union ship, even one known to contain only provisions. But in addition to giving Seward's schemes a last chance, he was building a historical record to prove his peaceable intent throughout the crisis. By this point, he was fairly sure that the Sumter expedition would lead to bloodshed. When the governors of Indiana, Ohio, Maine, and Pennsylvania suggested the desirability of putting their state militias in fighting shape, he replied, "I think the necessity of being ready increases. Look to it." On April 12th, while the Union fleet lay helpless offshore, the Confederates began bombarding Fort Sumter, and after 34 hours, Anderson and his garrison were forced to surrender. The war had begun. Afterward, Lincoln gave several explanations of his course during the Sumter crisis. In his July 4th message to Congress, he spoke of his decision to supply Fort Sumter as contingent on the reinforcement of Fort Pickens. The Sumter expedition was intended to be ultimately used or not according to circumstances. He implied, though he never quite stated, that he would have canceled this expedition had he been able to reinforce Fort Pickens. Success at Fort Pickens would be a clear indication of policy, which would better enable the country to accept the evacuation of Fort Sumter as a military necessity. But this interpretation wasn't supported by contemporaneous evidence. In none of Lincoln's letters or messages between his inauguration and the firing on Fort Sumter was the relief of the two forts linked. In all probability, his memory failed him, and the policy he described to Congress in his July 4th message more accurately represented Seward's tactics rather than his own. While Lincoln was preparing this message, Browning visited the White House, and the two old friends naturally talked about how the war began. According to Browning's rather arid diary, Lincoln didn't denounce the Confederates, who, after all, fired the first shots, nor did he express any feeling of regret, much less of guilt, over his own role in bringing on the war. He mentioned the terrible stress of the weeks between his inauguration and the attack on Fort Sumter, and spoke of his physical exhaustion, but he didn't acknowledge that his ineffectual leadership contributed to the crisis, and made no mention of divided councils in the administration, inadequate preparation of the relief expeditions, and bureaucratic snarls and inter-service rivalries. He probably remembered an instructive letter that Browning wrote him before his inauguration. In any conflict between the government and the seceding states, it's very important that the traitors shall be the aggressors, and that they be kept constantly and palpably in the wrong. The first attempt to furnish supplies or reinforcements to Sumter will induce aggression by South Carolina, and then the government will stand justified before the entire country in repelling that aggression and retaking the forts. That was the scenario Lincoln had followed in sending the Sumter expedition. "The plan succeeded," he told Browning. "They attacked Sumter. It fell, and thus did more service than it otherwise could." These weren't idle words. When Gustavus Fox, bitter over the failure of his expedition to relieve Fort Sumter, asked for endorsement from his commander-in-chief, Lincoln responded, "You and I both anticipated that the cause of the country would be advanced by making the attempt to provision Fort Sumter, even if it should fail. And it's no small consolation now to feel that our anticipation is justified by the result." These cryptic utterances didn't mean that Lincoln sought to provoke war. His repeated efforts to avoid collision in the months between his inauguration and the firing on Fort Sumter showed that he adhered to his vow not to be the first to shed fraternal blood. But he'd also vowed not to surrender the forts. That, he was convinced, would lead to the actual and immediate dissolution of the Union. The only resolution of these contradictory positions was for the Confederates to fire the first shot. The attempt to relieve Fort Sumter provoked them to do just that. Had the expedition been successful, the fort, which had no military value to the United States, would eventually have been abandoned because it couldn't be defended against a determined Confederate assault. In that sense, as he told Browning, by falling, the fort did more service than it otherwise could. And to use a phrase from his letter to Fox, the cause of the country would be advanced because everybody had to recognize that he did not start the war, but had war forced on him. After the attack, he told the Congress, no choice was left but to call out the war power of the government, and so to resist force employed for its destruction by force for its preservation.
This ends Disc 16.